rätselhafte Todesfälle, naturwissenschaftlicher Tiefgang und Empfehlungen, wie Sie den Alltag möglichst unbeschädigt überleben. Hallo, hier spricht Florian Klenk und am Freitag, den 26. April 2024, läuft die dritte Staffel von Klenk und Reiter, dem Falter-Podcast aus der Gerichtsmedizin. Christian Reiter und ich kredenzen Ihnen jeden Freitag einen neuen Fall. Sie finden uns auf falter.at/Gerichtsmedizin und überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Die Wiener Festwochen 2023, 12. Mai bis 21. Juni. Programm und Karten auf festwochen.at. Gute Unterhaltung beim folgenden Podcast wünschen Ihnen Erste Bank und Wiener Städtische, die Hauptsponsoren der Wiener Festwochen.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falterradio. In dieser Sendung führen wir Sie auf eine Reise im Theater durch ein Museum. Das Museum, das ist die Sowjetunion. Der Staat, den Lenin einst als Vaterland der Werktätigen begründet hat und als Folge der demokratischen Revolutionen von 1989 zerfallen ist. Theatermacherin Marina Davidova hat ein neues Stück geschrieben mit dem Titel »The Museum of Uncounted Voices«, das Museum der ungezählten Stimmen. Sie hören gleich ein Gespräch mit Marina Davidova, das ich gemeinsam mit Mischa Glenny vom Institut für die Wissenschaften vom Menschen führe. Die Weltpremiere des Stücks »The Museum of Uncounted Voices« findet am 22. Mai bei den Wiener Festwochen im Odeon-Theater statt. Es gibt verschiedene Museumssäle in diesem Stück. Hören Sie aus dem Saal 1 mit dem Titel »Imperium«, einen Sprecher, die riesige Landkarte Russlands bewundern, mit Widerrede gleich drauf eines ukrainischen Sprechers aus dem Saal 2 namens »Nationen«.
»You are now standing on the largest country in the entire world. I invite you to study this map a little closer. Please, take a seat in this room for a short while. Go on. Take a seat. You will be able to continue to the exhibition later. It's astonishing, isn't it?
I thought I would laugh my head off as I was listening. What was he saying? That Moscow was the successor to ancient Rus, that it annexed the Ukrainian lands which once belonged to it. What's going on in their heads, those bastards?
Azizjan, do patmo meish Litva imets ishanutsyan masin. Uzmes, yes, imets ayreniki masin patmem.
Sorry, you must speak in language we all understand.
No one here speaks Armenian.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Can you help me, Janikas, my dear? We have been told about the greatness of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. Please, show them the great Armenia. Ah, I see. Of course. Our map has been hung to one side. We have been sidelined as usual, so no one can see us.
Auf die Stimmen verschiedener Nationen der Sowjetunion, Armenien, Belarus, Aserbaidschan, Georgien folgt eine Unterhaltung auf der Bühne.
Dears, why are you all sitting there? Please, come over here. The museum is over here and not over there. At least you'll find out in what part of the world Armenia is. Come on, come on, come. Don't be afraid. Stand up, come. Do you want me to sing something for you in Armenian? There is a song my grandmother used to sing me. Tercei matkoftun urimairaner artur tesnei. I'm waiting for you.
Ha biz de gözlürük. Təkcə siz də öz...
Çöyünə qoyla arvelodur, bit.
Ha biz onsuz da həmişə qırağda qalırıq.
Ara, qoqu, desəm qədiləb, tan.
Please, speak a language we can all understand. We are not obliged to understand Georgian or Azeri especially.
Das waren die Stimmen von Odin Biron, Alexander Jatsenko, Gurgen Zaturyan, Igor Shugaleyev, Jamal Ali und Luka Kalandadze. Marina Davidova, die das Stück Museum of Uncounted Voices geschrieben hat, war bis letztes Jahr in Moskau 23 Jahre lang Leiterin des Neuen Europäischen Theaters. Sie hat sich gegen den Ukraine-Krieg ausgesprochen und musste fliehen. Aufgewachsen ist sie als Tochter armenisch-russischer Eltern in Baku, im heutigen Aserbaidschan, wo die elterliche Wohnung in einem anti-armenischen Pogrom zerstört wurde. Im Herbst übernimmt Marina Davidova die Schauspielleitung der Salzburger Festspiele. Und ich freue mich sehr, dass Marina Davidova in hektischen Tagen der Probe für das Stück Museum of Uncounted Voices für ein Gespräch Zeit gefunden hat, das wir auf Englisch führen. Welcome, Marina Davidova, in the podcast Falter Radio. Hello.
Hello.
We are also joined by Misha Glenny. Hello, Misha.
Hello.
Misha Glenny is rector of the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna. Marina Davidova, your piece, Museum of Uncounted Voices, in a way recreates for us the Soviet Union. It gives us a kind of guided tour through the Soviet Union. Now in the form of a museum. Now in museums, usually we put stuff that we think is worth to remember, perhaps in order to understand the present. Why is it worth to have a guided tour through the Soviet Union and through the Soviet times?
Actually, is it a question? Yeah. Actually, I cannot say that all you will see in the performance is dedicated only to the Soviet Union, because the voices and these uncounted voices as well, they are discussing history in general. And sometimes they start to talk about the 14th and 19th centuries. But yes, mostly it's focused on the Soviet Union time, Soviet Union period, and the Soviet Union borders. But still, it's not, I cannot call this performance, this piece, a piece about Soviet Union. No, it's about some more general issues and problems. And
why uncounted voices?
Because I believe that all the historical discourses, they also always have some voices that they didn't took into consideration. They didn't count them, and so they, to my mind, they know. Objective history, it's always, it's a very special point of view, and somebody can suggest another point of view on the same events, you know. It's like in Rashomon, in this very famous novel and classical movie, so it was a kind of starting point. I wanted to tell the in the museum when I in my life when I came to historical museums, you know, it was a kind of my imagination there, that because I always felt the performative power of this space, and in my imagination, objects suddenly start to live somehow, to have their spirit, and some voices of the past centuries like appeared in the air, and it was in my head. They started to argue to each other, and so it's why I decided to make this museum. But then the second idea was that really, when we have an excursion at the museum, it's always it suggests like one point of view on all the events. And but I just imagined how the history of former Russian Empire or then Soviet Union is told, would be told by different voices.
Now, discussing the Soviet Union, you have, of course, in mind the Russia of today, today's Russia. And we all know the famous quote by Vladimir Putin, who said that the disappearance of the Soviet Union was one of the biggest, or was the biggest tragedy of history. Now, when the Soviet Union disappeared, you were in your 20s, you were working as theater critic in Izvestia and then
newspapers. That time I was...
That's what I read in the internet.
Yeah. Okay. No. I worked in Izvestia, of course, but it was a bit later because when the Soviet Union fell apart, collapsed. I was a postgraduate student in Moscow. I started to work as a theater critic a bit later. At that time, I was a theater historian. I wrote my dissertation, my thesis.
How did you, Marina Davidova, experience this break from the Soviet Union to Russia? And how different is Russia today from the Soviet Union?
Unfortunately, now it's not very much different from the Soviet Union. And it's happened just like in front of my eyes, before our eyes, how this independent and free Russia turned to be a new Soviet Union. Because, we, of course, as for repressions and this censorship and some other awful things, we came back to the Soviet Union, to the Soviet time. But as for this collapse of the Soviet Union, it's a very important, very interesting question. What was my personal experience? Because it was a very special experience. And partly, I will tell about it in my performance, because I'm at the same time I was a liberal, which claimed, of course, the changes which were happening in during Perestroika. I was absolutely inspired by all the spirit of Perestroika, and at the same time I was a real victim of this collapse, as I was born in Baku. And
Azerbaijan.
Today, Azerbaijan. Yes, independent Azerbaijan. And I have my father was Armenian. And I know what. Actually, I became a refugee for the second time in my life now.
So the first time being expelled from Baku as a kid from an Armenian, partly Armenian. Family. Now, Misha, today's Russia, of course, there is a former KGB boss who rules the country. But on the other hand, the Soviet Union was not a nationalist, a Russian nationalist state. It was different from the Russian Empire. Seen from outside, Misha Glenny, how would you see the similarities and the differences between today's Russian Federation and the Soviet Union?
Well, there were occasions during the Soviet Union when the leadership would invoke Russian nationalism, most importantly during the Second World War, the Great Patriotic War, as it was known, in the Soviet Union, where Stalin looked back to Russian history for inspiration. That's why he commissioned Sergei Eisenstein to make Ivan the Terrible.
And Alexander Nevsky.
And Alexander Nevsky as well. And so you had these symbols of Russian history, which were inspiring the people of Leningrad and Stalingrad and so on to fight on behalf of Russia. And he also liberalized the Orthodox Church at this time as well. He sought to mobilize the Orthodox Church on behalf of the defense of the Soviet Union. Then, of course, you return to a period of repression of specifically of Russian nationalism, but the Soviet Union never really quite understood to what extent it was a Russian phenomenon, to what extent it was a multinational phenomenon, and throughout its existence, it was sort of schizophrenic. The interesting thing is, Raimund, is if you look from the outside onto the Soviet Union, that for many people, to an extent in Europe, but to a much greater extent in other parts of the world, the parts we call the global south, the Soviet Union and Russia are more or less interchangeable. And so if you see leaders like Lula today or Cyril Ramaphosa, for example, they look at what's happening between Russia and Ukraine at the moment, and their muscle memory is filtered through their understanding of Western imperialism, because they were brought up at a time when the United States in particular, but Europe as well, was imposing all sorts of unpleasant regimes on them. And the ANC, for example, in South Africa, were hugely dependent on support from the Soviet Union. Jacob Zuma, the former president, deeply corrupt character, was educated in Moscow by the KGB, speaks fluent Russian.
One could perhaps say the Soviet past for today's Russia is less a burden than an advantage for Putin's policy.
It is an advantage because, you know, as the old saying about the Jesuits goes, give me a boy when he's eight and he's mine for the rest of his life. And that's the case with Jacob Zuma, for example, and the KGB. The Russians, when they invaded Ukraine, what was really interesting was that Putin's people did not bother to try and counter the narrative, the Ukrainian narrative, in Europe and the United States. They knew that they'd lost that Ukraine had won it. But Putin put a lot of effort to ensure that India, South Africa, Brazil, other parts of the global south, who he realized would be important in this conflict because it had global implications, that's where he put his effort. And he was able to do that on relatively fertile ground because of that complex relationship in the past that the global south had with the Soviet Union.
Marina Davidova, how much of Soviet traditions are alive in Putin's foreign policy beyond this opportunism to try to profit from the anti-colonial tradition of the Soviet Union, the anti-capitalist tradition of the Soviet Union that is popular in Africa and Latin America? Because on the other hand, what Russia is waging, the wars Russia is waging in Ukraine, but also in the Caucasus, somehow are colonial wars, aren't they?
As far as I understand, you now don't ask me, because of course for me it's a colonial war, but you are asking what is the attitude of our authorities and the majority of the people to this war. I don't think that they consider it a colonial war. For them, it's it's a global war with a global West, you know. And of course, you know, when you say these two words, the Soviet Union, a lot of people think that it was a kind of very homogenical, like, phenomena. But actually, we can now say about an attempt to revive Stalinistic Soviet Union. Because, I'm not a big fan of all this Bolshevik revolution of 17, but actually there were a lot of leftist ideas during 20s, for example, and so on. And even Lenin, which was a huge rascal, but he wasn't a Russian imperialist or nationalist at all. But as for Stalin, he was. And he, step by step, he tried to revive Russian Empire, which was called Soviet Union, But actually, what he realized in under these leftist slogans, it was rather a rightist idea of a very strong state and a very imperialistic idea, of course. And it what our authorities and Putin himself, but not only him, are trying to copy paste now, you know.
Today, are we witnessing a re-Stalinization of Russian history? What's the place of Stalin in of the official Russia of Vladimir Putin?
How to answer your question? You know, Russia, it used to be, and it is now, a very hypocritical country. So if you read like some official documents, of course, they will not announce it like openly that what we are realizing now, it's our attempt to cosplay like Stalinistic regime. But in fact, they are doing it. And if you just look at a lot of our websites, which I pretty sure were created by FSB people, they mostly are telling people about how Stalin, how great was Stalin as a politician, how great was our country under Stalin. It's a very, very important discourse of runet of Russian internet.
Misha Glendy, how worrying is this new, if you compare it to Khrushchev and the de-Stalinization, it's a new appraisal of Stalin in today's Russia? How worrying is that?
It's obviously deeply worrying because freedom of expression, intellectual exchange has been suppressed ruthlessly, systematically, and of course, you know, particularly as they're now close friends with the Chinese, they have, if they want, the ability technologically to monitor and introduce surveillance techniques, the like of which even Stalin could only dream of. I mean, you know, in the long term, there will be a real problem for Russia and for Russians that now that Putin has determined that they're going to go down this totalitarian path. Because there's a very interesting thing about Russian identity and Russian imperialism. There are only two empires in this world in the modern period which are effectively land empires, and that is Russia and the United States. And what that means in the Russian case is nobody knows where Russia begins and nobody knows where Russia ends. And so this is why, in terms of convincing the Russian population, you can persuade them that Ukraine is, you know, that was where Russia was anyhow, and so this belongs to us. And then that only takes a little more, and you go into the movement of Ukrainians are not a proper people, and the language is merely a dialect, and this sort of thing. And when it comes to the outside world, and I want to go back just for a second on this global South thing, when the West go to places like South Africa or Kenya or Brazil or Colombia and say, what you're seeing is a colonial war, everyone else's experience of the colonial war are British ships coming in and slaves being taken across to Latin America or the United States or Caribbean. It is an imperialism that is experienced as an invasion. And that's not quite the same as what happened with the expansion of the Russian Empire, which is a huge empire. But in the long term, Putin placing everything on Russian nationalism is going to do immense damage to the Russian people because they have a demographic problem in the long term, which is going to come back and create immense problems for them. And when Putin dies, probably like any mafia leader, he is not going to leave a coherent succession after him. And I fear greatly that Russia will fall into a period of immense instability, not unlike the time of troubles after the period of Ivan Grozny, Ivan the Terrible, when it was consumed by infighting and a sort of internecine warfare. And Putin, I think, runs a real risk as leaving this as his legacy, along with all the terrible things that have happened in Ukraine, Chechnya, and elsewhere.
We are not there yet, of course. Marina Davidova, in how far does this situation of imperial feeling explain the fact that Russian society at the beginning, where at the beginning there were quite some protests against the war, against the mobilization, but after a year, more than a year, it seems Russian society has accepted in large parts this war and the waging of war and through repression, but not only, maybe also through an imperialist ideology, accepted that there have to be attacks against Ukrainian cities and this war is fought for Russia. Is that true? How do you have left Russia because of you were against the war, of course. But how do you see the situation of civil society or what is left of civil society in Russia today in relation to the war?
Look, of course, this imperialistic idea is rather close to the people because they a lot of them think that Russia is everywhere where Russian people live. It's a very simple idea. So it was very easy to persuade them that Ukraine is just a part of Russia and we have a right to invade Ukraine. But at the same time, it's very important to understand the general attitude of Russian people to the political issues. Because unlike Western people, for Russians mostly, not all, of course for all of them, but for a majority of the people, the political life is very similar to natural phenomena. Like if it's raining in the street, what shall I do? Shall I fight against rain? No, it's very stupid. I have just to take my umbrella and to put on my coat on me. That's it. So, okay. It's like normal way of thinking. Okay, the war started. So what shall I do? It's important. There's no need to protest because it's like it doesn't depend on us. It's the normal attitude. So if the war started, so I have to either to leave the country or to be very, very quiet or maybe to do, maybe I should put that on my shop or on my theater, and so on and so on and so on. It's like people even don't think that something in political life depends on them. And it was long before the war started. I just had a lot of conversations with, you know, taxi drivers or the people in the shops and so on and so on. Very often I met such an attitude to all this part of life, the political life.
But on the other hand, Marino, there has been a democratic upsurge against Putin when 10 years ago, when he falsified elections, there were tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Moscow and Peter. And of course, there have been, also in the time of Gorbachev, I mean, there had been
democratic traditions, it's also part of Russian culture. Where did it go?
Well, it's very important part, of course, but it's minority. I'm pretty sure that it was a minority even during Perestroika and Gorbachev time. And it's just we were lucky. My generation and me, we were lucky that it's happily happened during Gorbachev era that this minority, I don't know, I am not a historian, but I feel some historical issues to my mind rather well. But it was a happy coincidence that this minority could win. And I think that what happened after Perestroika and during this practically 30 years, it's a kind of deviation of our history. But now we came back to the main road. And I'm sorry to say it, but it's how I feel.
It's a depressing...
yes, very depressing.
...analysis. The main road is the road of repression of...
Yeah, of course.
...state terrorism. I mean, yes. Stalin was state terrorism on
exactly.
a massive scale. Millions of people.
Millions, but of course, we are now having like light version of Stalinism. It's rather light, we have it, and we will have, to my mind.
Misha Glennie, let's come back to this contradiction in the Soviet Union. On the one hand, repression, on the dictatorship, the KGB, but on the other hand, the basic idea that this is an instrument, all the repression, the violence is an instrument in order to liberate the country and also to liberate the world from capitalism and the bad reality of imperialism in the world. This ideology was the reason why there was a lot of support for the Soviet Union in the West. Big communist parties, leftist parties, Communist Party of France and Italy, even if they have taken their distance from Stalinism, they sort of profited from the existence even of the Soviet Union. Is this contradiction sort of still present in Russia today, or is this a fiction that's gone and that maybe Lula believes in or Ramaphosa in South Africa believes in? Because the left in Western Europe also partly is rather lenient towards Putin and towards Russia.
Some parts of the West are, some parts of the Western left are, yes. The Soviet Union's reputation took a hammer blow in Western Europe and the United States, but particularly Western Europe in 1956 with the invasion of Hungary, and then in 1968 with the invasion of Czechoslovakia during the Prague Spring, and most of the communist parties in Western Europe then adopted what became known as Eurocommunism, which was basically to work within the democratic frameworks of the West. And the allure of the Soviet Union was largely restricted to the global South after that. And then, of course, with the invasion of Afghanistan, a lot of in the final days of 1979, a lot of people began to perceive the Soviet Union as just another imperialist structure. And so by the time it collapsed, there wasn't a huge amount of sympathy for it around the world. I mean, I think what one has to remember always in trying to understand why Putin reemerges and why Russia goes back to what Marina calls the main road, which I have Russian history, which is, you said, is truly depressing, was that during the period of freedom during the 1990s was exceptionally chaotic. And it was a very violent time, particularly the first 5 years of the 1990s. It was known as gangster capitalism. You had the rise of the oligarchs who became extremely wealthy, while a large part of the Russian population were impoverished. Meanwhile, in the background, there was terrible destruction going on during the First and Second Chechen Wars. This was a very traumatized society. And what I think that Putin landed upon, what he realized, is that this was a society which was ready for a strongman, which was ready for a return to the main road. What didn't happen, however, was the restoration of a Soviet-style socialism. This is what I called at the time market authoritarianism, where you did allow the markets still to be critical in the development of the economy. But what Putin understood is, whereas in the 1990s, the oligarchs controlled the politics, i.e. the oligarchs controlled Yeltsin, for Putin, what was critical was that he needed to control the oligarchs. And this was the revenge of the KGB, in my opinion. He went about reestablishing the security state as the primary structure of the Russian Federation. In the West, you're absolutely right. There are still a number of prominent Western leftists who blame NATO for the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I have to say that there is some merit to the argument that the West moved too fast with the expansion of NATO, and it wasn't really paying attention as to what was going on in Russia at the same time. The point about when I speak to people on the left here who say that this is all NATO's fault, that Putin's hand was forced, I have to say, well, you can make an argument about that up until the point where Putin invades Ukraine and starts bombing civilian targets, allows his army to rape Ukrainian women, to slaughter Ukrainian civilians, to kill children, to bomb Mariupol in the way that he did, and so on and so forth. There is no justification for the actions that the Russian military have undertaken since February 2022. And, you know, we can argue about the politics behind it, but we have to condemn the action itself under all circumstances.
Misha, probably even the people on the left who criticize NATO most of the time, nearly all the time, they would agree on that point. Even the most critical anti-American leftists would agree that the attack against Ukraine is a big crime. Let me come back a little bit, Marina, to conclude, to the contradictions in the Soviet tradition and the presence of these contradictions of the Soviet, the socialist tradition, the communist tradition, which is not only terrorism, KGB, Stalin, Chistka, which is also the idea of a just society and overcoming the injustice of our societies. In how far are there any residues of this big starting idea of communism, which started with Marx in the 19th century? Is there anything left here in Russia of today? Because in the West, yes, there is something left. Even in Salzburg, we had recently in Austria a big success of the Communist Party of Austria in the elections with a very charismatic young leader who says, well, he is, of course, condemning Stalinism, but this is history, and he wants a new start. Any elements of this ideas of communism and socialism left in Russia?
No, I don't think so. I don't feel any communist or socialist ideas which are really could survive in now present Russia. And even more, I think that at least in the middle of 30s, at least, as I told before, what Stalin did, it was an implementation of absolutely rightist ideas and leftist slogans. And even Soviet intelligentsia and post-Soviet intelligentsia, mostly they hated these leftist ideas. We have a very big idiosyncrasy to the all the leftist trends, you know, because we actually read it in the textbooks. And it was they were obliged to be communists, and then it was it's very actually a very long story, and it's very difficult to say all these things in 5 minutes. But still, I think that neither inside the country nor outside. Nowadays Russia is has nothing to do with leftist ideas, but the similarity for me between Soviet Union and today Russia is the how to explain it to you. It will be very strange to hear it, but it's a kind of simplification of life. Of simplification of reality, you know, people mostly they psychologically for them it's easier to live in a this simplified reality where we have enemies and like black and white reality. So it's how people lived in Soviet Union. Yet there was global. Awful capitalistic world, and we are here trying to survive in this. We are surrounded by enemies, but we will survive. And now we have the same picture. It's not capitalistic world; it's just a Western world, global West. But we are trying to survive in this awful situation, and we will win, of course, because we will. Overcome, we will never surrender. It's like this, and I can see that for many people, even simple people, psychologically it's very very easy to live with such a picture of reality in their heads. So because before the reality was very complex. And there was no only one truth, you know. You can there were discussions about our life and so. There's no discussions now. Everybody knows where our enemies and where our evil. This global evil, and we have to fight with this global evil.
Well, that's a gloomy, but I'm afraid realistic picture, Marina Davidova. Thank you very much for this discussion and for your time. Thank you. Misha Glenny. This was a podcast produced in cooperation with the Wiener Festwochen, and we're looking forward to the upcoming shows of Marina Davidova's piece, Museum of Uncounted Voices. The first show is scheduled for May, starting with the premiere on May 22nd. Thank you very much for your interest. The intro music comes from Ursula Winterauer, Philipp Dietrich, und Miriam Hübel, the Sound Engineers. Ich verabschiede mich im Namen des gesamten Teams. Bis zur nächsten Sendung.